It's Tuesday, July 5th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello. Coming up, new attacks in Saudi Arabia, Iraq, and Bangladesh signal a rise in Islamic State-supported terror.
The Chinese see these waters as their exclusive waters and not as high seas or international waters or waters in dispute.
China prepares to ignore an international court ruling on the South China Sea. A big planetary rendezvous. And preventing smartphones from taking photos and videos at concerts. It's all on today's International Edition. A suicide bomber killed himself and wounded two security guards near the U.S. consulate building in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia on Monday. The kingdom has been rocked by violence claimed by Islamic State militants since 2014. Later, an explosion killed four people at a checkpoint outside of one of Islam's holiest sites, the Prophet's Mosque in the Saudi city of Medina. The mosque, the second holiest site in Islam, is the burial site of the Prophet Muhammad and is visited by millions of Muslims from across the globe each year. In Baghdad, 3 days of mourning are being observed after two attacks killed more than 140 people and wounded some 200 others on Sunday. The deadliest attack in the central Quetta district was claimed by the Islamic State group. And in Bangladesh, also in mourning, authorities are downplaying an Islamic State claim of responsibility for Friday's attack on a Dhaka restaurant that killed 20 people, mostly foreigners. The home minister said homegrown militants were to blame. Greg Barton, a professor of global Islamic politics at Australia's Deakin University, tells VOA's Victor Beatty this represents what he calls a dangerous degree of delusion or denial by the Bangladeshi government.
To be fair to them, Islamic State's only been claiming a presence there since the first attack on an Italian aid worker in September 2015, whereas its al-Qaeda affiliate, Ansar al-Islam, has been active there for years. And for years, most of the attacks by local Bangladeshis by this al-Qaeda affiliate were against liberal Muslims. But since September last year, we've seen targeted attacks against non-Muslims by groups claiming to be linked to Islamic State. And the whole thing about the way Islamic State works around the world is that the international attacks are generally carried out by people who are citizens of their own countries and have grown up in their own, often the very neighborhoods that they attack. So either the Bangladeshis are struggling to come to terms with this new dynamic, or for whatever political reason, they don't yet want to acknowledge it. But it would seem that we've reached an inflection point with the organized mass attack in the Dhaka bakery, in that given that one person has been arrested, one of the attackers survived, the links with Islamic State, if that's what's indeed there, are going to become very clear, or at least the situation will become very clear. It's not an either-or case that because you have local, in this case, middle-class students who have become radicalized, that excludes international networks. That's not the way Islamic State works. It reaches into local networks and uses those people.
Greg, we've heard officials and analysts tell us that Islamic State is on the defensive, but is it strategy changing?
Well, on the ground in Iraq, Syria, it seems that they're falling back on the insurgent methods that took them into power. Once they'd taken Mosul, of course, they'd earlier taken Fallujah and Raqqa, they have been holding those cities by means of conventional force. But in some ways, the collapse of their force in Fallujah was suspiciously quick. It seems like they fully intended to pull back quickly, and they now seem to be falling back on insurgent activity in that same Anbar province. In other words, they decided not to defend what in the end would probably be an indefensible stronghold, but rather to fall back on insurgency. So the attacks in Baghdad, which have been part of years-long patterns but have really intensified over the last 12 months, fit that pattern of insurgency and terrorist methods. The attacks around the world, of course, are terrorist attacks, but it also speaks to a global insurgency. And it reminds us we're dealing with a hybrid organization in Islamic State. It's not just one thing in one place. It can do multiple things in multiple places all at once.
Georgetown University visiting Professor R. Nicholas Pallarino says Baghdad-type attacks will continue as long as groups like Islamic State possess safe havens.
As long as you have those safe havens where the Islamic State or even al-Qaeda or whatever other jihadist movement group is prevalent, then they're able to project their destruction to other areas, not only in the region, but also to Europe and hopefully never to the United States, but you never know what's going to happen at this point.
Well, as you know, we've had some high-profile bombings in recent weeks. You had, of course, Orlando, which apparently was inspired, at least, by Islamic State, if not outright claimed. You had the airport attack in Istanbul. You had the situation in Dhaka, Bangladesh, and now this in Baghdad. Is Islamic State tactics changing?
Well, I think as they lose some territory, they're going to strike out more. But that them losing territory does not mean that they are being degraded. They're going to export their terrorism wherever they can. And their overall objective is to demonstrate that the governments in these other countries that they're attacking cannot keep their citizens safe.
Our Nicholas Pellerino says defeating groups like Islamic State will take a two-part strategy, a global U.S.-led military operation and a successful effort at diminishing its ideology on social media. Well, social media is what we turn to right now as we check out what's trending online with our own G. Abby Lee. She joins me right here in Studio 22 to tell us what people are saying about the rapidly changing political landscape in Britain. Hi, G.
Hi, Jim. Ever since the EU referendum, the UK political scene resembles a little bit of the American TV show House of Cards. What do you think?
Yes,
a little
I think
bit,
so.
Right? The latest news that people are talking about on social media is the resignation of Nigel Farage, who is a leader of the UK Independence Party. He posted on Facebook and Twitter that he has decided to stand aside as a leader of his party. You can find the full statement on Facebook, but let's just read the first two sentences together. He wrote, "I have decided to stand aside as leader of UKIP. The victory for the Leave side of the referendum means that my political ambition has been achieved."
And how is the online community responding to this?
It was quite difficult to find any negative comments to that specific Facebook post. A lot of the most liked comments were calling Farage a true British patriot and the most apt candidate as the next prime minister. His supporters were also urging him to stay at least until the process of Brexit from the EU gets started.
Well, it sounds like he has a very devoted following. Mm-hmm. Moving on to Twitter, what's the buzz there?
Farage tweeted about his resignation and shared a link to his full statement on the UKIP website, and more than 4,000 people liked that tweet within 9 hours. He also changed the description on his Twitter page, calling himself as a UKIP member of the European Parliament as opposed to the party's leader.
And what's the media reaction like?
Sky News, which is a 24-hour news operation based in the UK, which I kind of consider it as the UK version of CNN, mm-hmm. tweeted a clip from his announcement on resignation. And it captioned it, "Nigel Farage said, in the future, I won't be constrained when I answer questions. The real me will now come out." Now, to that tweet, many people asked whether he was ever constrained in his speech. As you know, he is widely known as the one who speaks up his mind. That's all for me today. Jim?
Well, definitely he does. I've heard a few of his speeches. Thank you so much for that wrap-up, G. You can tweet your comments and questions to @VOA_IE. That's our International Edition Twitter stream. And you can also find myself and G on Twitter, @VOA Stevenson and @GAbbyLee. Among the top stories trending right now in Asia, Bangladesh mourns as investigators question hostages rescued from attack. Who were the Dhaka attackers? Aide to Chinese ex-president Hu Jintao gets a life sentence. Taiwan's misfired anti-ship missile strains China ties. Pakistan's grant for controversial Islamic seminary under review. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at the voanews.com website. And if you have a smartphone, check out our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. China says it will hold a week's worth of military exercises beginning today in the disputed South China Sea from east of Hainan Island to the disputed Paracel Islands, also claimed by Vietnam and Taiwan. The exercises are to end a day before a UN Court of Arbitration is expected to rule July 12th in a case brought by the Philippines challenging the validity of Beijing's vast claims in the South China Sea. Malcolm Cook, a senior fellow at the Singapore-based Institute for Southeast Asian Studies.
The fact that the operations, as reported so far, are going to take place in the Paracel Islands that are far away from the Philippines suggests that they're not targeting the Philippines, but are more a general expression of Chinese force and commitment to their claims in the South China Sea. The fact that they've said that ships will be blocked from the military area during the military exercises reasserts that the Chinese see these waters as their exclusive waters and not as high seas or international waters or waters in dispute with Vietnam in this case.
Meanwhile, the state-run China Daily on Monday said Beijing is prepared to negotiate with Manila if it ignores the Hague-based Permanent Court of Arbitration's ruling. Malcolm Cook says it's not clear what the position of new Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte is on the issue.
During the campaign for the president and after, there's been some conflicting messages where at one point in the campaign he criticized the decision of the Aquino government to take China to the arbitration tribunal, noting, as has been the Chinese position, that China will not respect whatever the ruling is. But after some criticism, he and his team have clarified that they will support or uphold the ruling of the tribunal and use that as the basis for their negotiations. So it's becoming clearer how the new president will address the situation, and that makes it less likely that that will be able to restart effective bilateral talks with China.
The state-run China Daily newspaper repeated China's non-participation and non-acceptance position on the ruling, neither being a part of the process nor accepting its ruling. While the United States takes no position on the sovereignty claims among China and its neighbors, it does oppose any limits on access by China to the South China Sea, which is a vital international waterway for trade. At this hour, it's still July 4th here in the United States as we celebrate our 240th Independence Day. Part of that celebration is taking place far away as NASA's solar-powered Juno spacecraft is arriving right now at Jupiter after an almost five-year journey. International Edition's Lori London talked to Greg Redfern, NASA Jet Propulsion Lab's Solar System Ambassador, about what the exploration will entail and what it could reveal about the largest planet in our solar system.
This is called Juno to the planet Jupiter. And Jupiter is the largest planet in the solar system. It's known as the king of the planets. So Juno is going to be arriving at Jupiter on the nation's birthday to begin a wonderful 20 months of exploration of the king of the planets up close and personal.
And what will it be doing? Will it be taking pictures? I assume it's not going to be able to land on there.
Well, you're right. It's not going to land. It's going to orbit. And it's going to have a special orbit, Lori, that takes us over the north and south pole of Jupiter for the first time in our exploration of the planets. And it will get to within 3,100 miles at its closest approach during this orbit to give us an unprecedented view with the Juno Cam, a camera designed to return pictures, as well as the scientific instruments. This whole mission is designed to finally answer some questions about what is Jupiter made of, what's in the cloud tops, is there water, what's the gravity field of this giant planet like? What's the magnetic field? And we're really going to rewrite the textbooks on Jupiter.
What do we stand to gain from understanding more about this planet?
In learning more about Jupiter, we're going to learn more about our solar system. Why do we have four rocky planets that we call the terrestrial planets? That's Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars. And why do we have four giant gas giant planets, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune? We're going to learn about how our solar system forms, how to planets form, and we're going to find out how the biggest planet in the whole solar system is comprised, what it's made of, how it came about, and that helps in our knowledge of how we, planet Earth, came into existence and evolved.
If all goes as planned, what can we expect and when?
The spacecraft on autopilot on July 4th is supposed to begin pre-Jupiter orbit insertion operations. And what that essentially means is the spacecraft is going to prepare itself to align to fire its main engine for 35 minutes starting at about 11:16 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, July 4th. And what our listeners have to realize, Jupiter is 534 million miles away, which means it takes radio signals traveling at the speed of light, and that's 186,000 miles a second. And
wow,
as fast as that is, it still takes us 48 minutes one way from Jupiter to our radio antennas to collect those signals. And if all goes well, it will enter into an orbit around Jupiter, being captured by the giant gravity well of Jupiter.
Greg Redfern, NASA Jet Propulsion Lab's Solar System Ambassador. And you can follow this amazing mission on our website at voanews.com. Be sure to follow us as well on Twitter at @VOA_IE. And you can like us on Facebook at VOA Now. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
VOA's International Edition. The Apple company has recently been granted a patent that would disable an iPhone's camera temporarily. That would prevent fans from perhaps videoing or photographing live concerts inside a venue. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with VOA Soul Lounge host Shauna Renee about the software, which can also be used to enhance someone's experience, say, at a museum or art gallery.
First of all, I don't think this is a bad idea.
And I agree with you. Now, I think we may be in the minority with this, but I think in theory, it's a good idea. I mean, as you say, if you've been to a concert recently, it is almost impossible to see over the phones. And we've heard a number of artists say on stage, please put your phones down or let me pose for a picture. Now, can you put them down? Because I would like for you to, I always say, see me through your eyes.
Well, Adele did that. Adele was in concert. I think it was in the Netherlands or somewhere, and or maybe in Britain. And she was like, no, love, no, right. I'm right here. No, really, put the phone down. I want you to see me live. And there were some artists who have actually stopped. There are some groups who have actually stopped their concerts and walked off.
Well, sure. And Alicia Keys recently in one of her shows asked that all of the concert goers put their phones in these little lock boxes that would not be unlocked or could not be unlocked until after the show. So you could keep it on you, but you couldn't use it. So this is actually a really big deal. And not only because I think artists want you to see them, but also because they have to be mindful of protecting their art from being distributed online without their permission and, of course, without them reaping any financial benefits from its spread. This is bootlegging, essentially.
Well, it's the way it works. Let's just explain it so people understand. The way it works is there would be a series of transponders in the venue itself,
mm-hmm.
and there's a certain frequency that would be transmitted by those transponders, and that would hit your iPhone.
Right.
And if you tried to take a picture or you tried to do video, then you would get something on your screen that says this function has been disabled.
Right.
So you could still call.
Yes.
You could still text.
Yes.
You could still, you know, answer your phone. You just couldn't take any photographs. You couldn't take any video.
Yes.
I don't have any problem with that, because back in the day, you couldn't take a camera into like a venue to take a picture of a concert.
Certainly.
It was on the ticket. No Certainly. Photography.
Yeah. And I think even like you say, to these days, it still is on the ticket, because I think artists really genuinely want people to enjoy it. But you can't take away people's phones because, again, they're almost like,
right.
you know, appendages.
Now, well,
like,
that's a civil liberties matter, too.
And it is. And now I think it's also, though, important to mention that this is not only about disabling the phone. There is another function that this software can be used for. And that is, let's say you're in a museum and you point your phone at an exhibit. A lot of information about that exhibit could appear on the phone as well. So those same infrared signals, yeah. instead of disabling your phone, can enable your phone to receive information. And then there are some questions, too, especially here in the States, about whether or not giving a company the ability to disable someone's phone in public is a good idea, since we've been dealing a lot with police brutality issues and knowing that sometimes being able to videotape certain occurrences affect the outcome of whatever issue should it go to court. But if you are a live music lover, this is something I think you need to be aware of, because it may affect the way you experience your show, for better or worse.
So are you a live music lover? Do you stream video, take video, or shoot photos when you go to see someone? Let us know your opinion. You can log on to our Facebook page. That's VOA Now. You can also send us a tweet. Shauna is at VOA Lady DJ or at VOA underscore music. Also, you can find Shauna's program, The Soul Lounge, on our website, voanews.com.
You know, we have no such restrictions here. You can point your cell phone at us anytime you like. Download our program, listen to it. And if you happen to come by our VOA studios, take a picture of us. We'd like that. You can find us at voanews.com anytime you like. Also on Facebook at VOA Now. And follow us on Twitter at VOA underscore IE. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Jim Harmon. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Have a super day ahead.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
Self-government, that is, a people exercising all the necessary functions of power without interference by a higher authority that they can't control themselves, is a core American value. It's also at the heart of the Declaration of Independence, which we celebrate today. Thomas Jefferson, the document's primary author, wrote that self-rule is the separate and equal station that a people are entitled to under the laws of God and nature. It didn't come easily. America's early history is marked by conflict with other countries threatened by Republican government and among Americans themselves over the ultimate form that that government would take. But the Declaration laid the framework for a nation that would endure and grow, inspiring similar independence movements around the world. When war first broke out between Britain and its North American colonists, few imagined, let alone supported, the creation of a new nation. Historians note that even as the fighting raged, the colonists were deeply divided over the future. Roughly a third came to believe a complete break with Britain was needed. A third remained loyal to the British crown, and a third simply wanted to be left alone to raise their families and do their jobs. The 56 men who signed the Declaration on July 4, 1776, cast the first votes for independence. Their fellow citizens ratified the choice, and with it the then radical principle that government should be based on the consent of the governed. While this is the event and cause we celebrate today, it isn't unique to Americans. It is embodied in the constitutions of many nations and observed in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights that we all recognize. In essence, then, Independence Day is a celebration of our common humanity.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.